Well, it sounds as though a good time is being had by all. And I need to put other glasses on to see if there's anyone here. But, oh, yes, hello. I can see you now. But I'll switch back to my reading glasses. But this is going to be a Bible study on the first day of Unleavened Bread. Thank you for finding this location. Congratulations. We thought we might be in trouble because we were warned by repeated signs that the road was closed ahead, no through road, don't come here, where do you think you're going? All these signs all the way along. And fortunately, we stopped and asked somebody, do you know where Fryening is? My sat-nav had never heard of it, hidden in the English countryside. And he said, yes, you turn up this road, which is about at least 3 yards wide. And, is that really it? And it said, Fryening Road. So there we go. We're all here. Congratulations. You could go home now, I suppose, but you're probably hoping there's something to eat later. So I'd better say what I've got to say first. Otherwise, if you ate first, there may be no audience. But I'm going to talk first. You'll have to wait for a little while before we eat. But thank you for making the effort and getting here. David Plumley and wife send their good wishes. They were planning to be here but weren't able to at the last minute. But thank you, all of you, for getting here today. There are lots of Bible passages that, like Isaiah chapter 29, verse 14, that talk about the work of God. Many, many passages. You'll think of many through the New Testament, especially. Jesus Christ said, my Father works and I work. And he also said, my meat is to do the work of God. So we read about the work of God, but not only in the New Testament, also the Old Testament. And this passage, Isaiah 29, verse 14, is similar. Isaiah 29, verse 14, we read, therefore, behold, I will proceed to do a marvelous work among the people, even a marvelous work and a wonder. This is Isaiah 29, verse 14. When you think about it, just about everything God does is a marvelous work and a wonder. The fact that you've got two legs, the fact that we've got fingers on our hands, they say the biggest difference between man and the animal world, and of course you could think of hundreds of differences immediately, I know, but one of the biggest differences is the voice box. No animal has a voice box like ours. No animal is able to communicate the way we do. And it's because a little child hears words and learns to communicate that they're able to think. When you think about it, you cannot really think without words. The presence of words uttered by our voice box goes into our brain and we're able to think using those words. No animal can think because it doesn't have the ability, the word base that we have. So a huge difference between us and the animal creation, the voice box. And the other thing that we might never think of in our entire lives, the distance between the thumb and the first finger and the sensitivity of that movement. Because the thumb and first finger are so sensitive, watchmakers in Switzerland can make incredible timepieces manipulating minuscule gears and cogs. We don't really think much about it. No animal has anything like the movement between the thumb and first finger than we have. So between ability to communicate and therefore think, and then the ability to make things and create because of the fine sensitivity of our hands, it's a wonder. It's a wonder, and just about everywhere you look, whether you look at the flowers on the table here, whether you look at the bloom on the trees, a leaf, a weed growing in your garden, a dandelion. Dandelions are beautiful, beautiful. Buttercups, daisies. My lawn is mainly dandelions, buttercups, and daisies. When I would say, I've got to mow, all this stuff is growing, my wife would say, you're not going to cut off all those beautiful buttercups. I think there is some grass in there somewhere, but I have to look pretty hard to find it. But everywhere you look, you see wonders. And here, Isaiah 29, verse 14, behold, I will proceed to do a marvelous work among this people. So God does his work among the people on earth, even a marvelous work and a wonder. The wisdom of their wise men will perish. The understanding of their prudent men, this is Isaiah 29:14, will be hidden. So human beings are no match with what God plans and does. The Bible says that God doesn't work the way we do. He doesn't think the way we do. We would never come up with the plan that God has of letting humanity live their own way for thousands of years, try every possible sort of government, every possible kind of invention. We're convinced that somewhere along the line we will crack the final walnut, that we'll finally discover the keys that we need to know to live in peace and prosperity. But somehow it never quite happens. God doesn't go about it the way man does. He's going to let man live his own way for thousands of years so that we find out that our way doesn't pay off. And we finally come to the conclusion God was right all along. However, okay, we can see from the Bible God has a work, that God does a work in this world, that God worked in Old Testament times, and particularly we see it with Jesus in New Testament times. But we still wonder, is God still in control of his work today? Is God actually in control of his work? Or has it sort of escaped his supervision? Has God in some way been left out of the picture? The things that are going on this earth, is God somehow left out? Or is God still masterminding his plan of the ages? Is he the mastermind? Is this Philadelphia era of his church still part of his plan? We wonder about these things. And we also wonder, just where are we today in the great sweep of prophecy? Where are you and I today? Where is our church? Where are our people? Where do we fit in the great relentless flow of history? Do we have hundreds of years before God intervenes? Where do we fit today? At what point in the panorama of prophecy do we actually fit? Now, some have thought, and I've been told, I haven't really heard this in public, I have heard from people privately, quite a number of people that attend various groups, but some are even preaching that the Philadelphia era of God's church is over. Some feel that the Philadelphia age of God's church was completed with the death of Mr. Herbert Armstrong. Some have imagined, and I choose the word wisely, some have imagined that the Philadelphia age of the church stopped after the two 19-year time cycles. Because for many years we wondered if there would be two 19-year time cycles for the work of God now, as there appears to have been in New Testament times. we see in New Testament times, starting with the death of Jesus Christ and the establishment of the Church of God around the time of Pentecost, 31 AD, we see a 19-year time cycle that took us to 50 AD. And then a voice in Macedonia said, come over and help us. A voice from Europe. Paul changed his plans and the gospel went to Europe for the first time. And then another 19 years followed until the wars of the Jews with the Romans, and you know the story, how eventually Jerusalem was surrounded with armies, and in 70 AD, 69 AD, the armies of Titus were there, Vespasian, and then turned over to his son Titus while he hurried off to Rome to put the crown on his head and crown himself emperor of the Roman Empire. But we know about the destruction of Jerusalem and God's people having to flee in that interim while Vespasian got ready to gather up his dirty washing and run back to Rome and then put his son in charge of completing the war against the Jews. In that interim, the armies pulled back a little from Jerusalem and the Christians were able to escape. And we know that some went up the Jordan River to the little town of Pella. Others took off from the coast to various parts of the Mediterranean, especially Ephesus, where there was already a considerable Jewish contingent, synagogues and Christians already. So we know that was taking place around 69 to 70 AD. So a second 19-year time cycle took place. And then there seems to have been a complete hiatus after 70 AD, a time of confusion. Everybody and his dog was using the name of Christ. It was a new idea. You can have all your sins forgiven. This was a new idea in the religious world. Normally, you had to give an offering. You had to take apples or fruit or money or something and put it in the lap of the idol or the god to get some kind of credence with God. And the religions of the world generally wanted you to pay and pay and pay. Now, some things never change. And I know my wife's family had a number of friends and family members that were Catholic in Nebraska. And one of them, there'd been a death in the family, and the priest had asked them to give some offering so they could have a mass. And they said, well, is it really necessary? Yes, absolutely essential. You have a mass for this deceased person because they're in purgatory and the mass will help to move them out. It'll help to move them along the road, you could say, to be free of purgatory. And a bit later, the priest said, you really need to have another mass. And they said, well, we had one. Yes, but he's still in purgatory. We need to get him out. And they had about three masses. And the priest said, what about one more mass? And they said, just how much of him is still left in purgatory? And the priest said, well, I think he's just about out. Maybe just, one part of his body in purgatory and part out. And they said, he was always a good jumper. We let him make it on his own. So this world has its own way of forming religion and getting people to part with their income. Well, anyway, the pictures we have of this Philadelphia age of God's church are not always clear to people. And some, as I say, believe and are preaching that it ended, the Philadelphia era, when Mr. Armstrong died. Others think it stopped after the two 19-year time cycles, similar to those two time cycles in the book of Acts and the New Testament in general. The first time cycle for us, of course, beginning back in 1934, when this work began. But the first cycle ended in 1953, when the gospel was carried into Europe over Radio Luxembourg. It broke free from North America for the first time. And we began getting letters from all over Europe. The Luxembourg signals came in fairly well at night time. To begin with, we were on the medium wave, 208 meter medium wave, was in the evening. I beg your pardon. To begin with, we were on the long wave, 1293 meters on Luxembourg on Thursday afternoons. That reached a certain amount into this country, but not very strongly. I would run home from school. I was still doing my A-levels then, and I'd charge home from school and listen at 4:15 to 4:45 every Thursday. Greetings, friends around the world. This is Herbert W. Armstrong with the good news of the world tomorrow. And I'd never heard anything quite like this. And I had listened to about a dozen religious radio programs over Radio Luxembourg. I couldn't quite place this. I couldn't work out whether he was Protestant, Methodist, Baptist, Congregational. He didn't seem to be a Pentecostal. I was trying to work out, where do you fit this voice? But I listened to those early programs, still remember them today. Those very first programs made quite an impact as Mr. Armstrong explained the Bible. But that was the first period of time, the first 19-year cycle, ending in January 1953. And then the gospel was carried to Europe, and we had a second period of 19 years when the gospel went around the globe. That period ended in 1972, and we wondered, is God only going to give us two time cycles? We didn't say that Jesus was going to return then. We said it might be that Jesus would return soon after that time. 1972 did reach a peak in the growth and impact of our work. At that time, that was the highest level we'd ever reached, the highest impact we were making, the most radio stations, the most response. So 1972 was a peak year, and we began to have difficulties after that time, and the work and income declined a little over the next 7 years. But people misunderstand, as human beings generally do. When it comes to the work of God, very few people understand. The remaining 14 years of Mr. Armstrong's life, the remaining period after 1972 until 1986, that time, 14 years, saw the most remarkable open doors. After 1972, for 14 years, we saw the most outstanding work in the entire history of the work of God. Even going back to New Testament times, never at any time since the lives of the apostles had we seen events like the 1970s and 1980s, where literally dozens of the leaders of this earth lined up asking Mr. Armstrong to visit them. It was a most unusual time. He was traveling about 300 days a year between different nations. In Japan, he was invited to meet eight following prime ministers. Somebody had the word.
Successive.
Thank you, sir. You see what the brain can do with words. Eight successive prime ministers. Incredible. We had eight Japanese Diet members that said, Mr. Armstrong, we are your sons. We want to travel with you and learn from you. They came in our plane to Pasadena, and they said, we want to learn from Ambassador College. Eight Japanese Diet members. Remarkable. We had a concert there in the auditorium, and they all sat in the front row. Mr. Armstrong was there in the front row. Mrs. Armstrong, of course, had died in 1967, I believe. And Mr. Armstrong was there in the front row, and all the Japanese Diet members lined up. And Mr. Armstrong plays the piano, as you know. He was quite musical. And he tended to move his hands with the melody and with the music. So he was there, as he often did, just sort of mentally playing the notes while the pianist was playing. And one of the Diet members noticed, and he pointed to Mr. Armstrong and pointed to the other Diet members, and they all began to move their hands up. This is what they must do in America, you see. So they were all keen to follow whatever they could. Very interesting to see how keen they were to learn from Mr. Armstrong and to be his sons. Very unusual. When Queen Sirikit came out there to the college, it almost put the State Department into shock and awe. I mean, what's going on? We're supposed to arrange this kind of thing. Why are these kings and queens going to Little Ambassador College in California? They couldn't figure it out. When we had a royal visit there at the Huntington Sheraton Hotel, they were in a state. They said, but we've never had a royal visit before. What's the protocol? How do we greet them? What do we do? Somebody said, phone Ambassador College. They did. How do we greet royalty? What is the protocol? We sent them Roman Borek, who looked after our auditorium and had a lot of experience on Broadway in New York. He explained to them all the royal protocol. You don't speak first. You stand there, and when they get out of the car, they speak first. You know, he gave them all the detail, and they relaxed. We got them out of the tight spot. People don't understand these things. Mr. Armstrong spent several visits with Anwar Sadat. He said he was one of the bravest men on the planet. He was willing to travel from Cairo to Jerusalem, something no Arab leader would do. He said, in the interest of peace, I'm willing to sacrifice my life. He did. As you know, Anwar Sadat was assassinated in an auditorium by a Muslim fanatic. His wife was with him at the time. Mr. Armstrong was just a month or so later back in Europe and went to Egypt. Mrs. Sadat said, you must come to see me. Mr. Armstrong met her. She said, I've got to show you what happened and where it was. She took him to the stadium, showed him where they were sitting, where the assailant was, how the murder took place. Mr. Armstrong said, you must visit us in Pasadena. Mrs. Sadat said, I'd love to come. So she came and was Mr. Armstrong's guest in his home in Pasadena. She brought an entourage with her, two or three people with her, including the top general in the army. And Mr. Armstrong was with them for the night to be remembered, for a dinner that we were enjoying just last night. And he was explaining about some of the world problems and the problems between the Jews and the Arabs. And the general said, just a minute, he wanted to intervene. I want to make a comment. Mr. Sadat shut him up. Shut up, we're listening to Mr. Armstrong. Top general in the Egyptian army had his mouth closed by the president's wife. Incredible. These, you couldn't make these stories up. But we lived through those days. Some of you will remember the articles in the worldwide news. As leader after leader, Franz Josef Strauss brought his wife from Germany. He'd met Mr. Armstrong in Europe. He said, I'd like to visit your ambassador college. And he did. And he was toured around all day long. At the end of the day, the man in line, he didn't become president, but he was in line to become president of Germany. At the end of the day, he said, today, we have been in paradise. A world leader making a comment about Ambassador College. They did a tour of the United States for about 2 or 2.5 weeks. And at the end of the tour, he asked his wife, is there anything you want to do before we go back to Germany? She said, I'd like to visit Ambassador College again. Strange how these world leaders saw something that some of our own people perhaps never quite understood that God had done something very unusual in building Ambassador College. Well, those last 14 years of Mr. Armstrong's life after 1972 saw the most remarkable open doors since New Testament times. And as I said, not really at any time since the days of the apostles have we seen literally dozens of world leaders lined up wanting to have an audience with the leader of the work of God. They saw something that attracted them. They didn't understand, of course, at this time. God was giving them a witness to the gospel of the soon coming kingdom of God. Mr. Armstrong would explain to them, there has to be new world government. He tried to find a way to get the point over in words they would understand. The only solution for this world is a new world government. They could see that. Some of them thought we have to have some kind of United Nations or some kind of human organization. Of course, Mr. Armstrong was speaking about what God reveals. A new government that will save this world from destroying itself. It was a message that they will understand once they are resurrected. And that will be the time of the great white throne judgment. The time when the valley of dry bones in Ezekiel 37 comes to life. You remember the story there, the song, "Dem bones, dem bones, dem dry bones. Hear the word of the Lord." It's a picture of the great resurrection, not only of the nation of Israel. Israel is symbolic of the world. God is not a respecter of persons. When all Israel is resurrected, the whole world will be resurrected at that time. And as Jesus said in John chapter 5, verse 25, John chapter 5, verse 25, Jesus said, "The hour is coming." John 5, verse 25. "The hour is coming when the dead will hear the voice of the Son of God." John 5, verse 25. "The hour is coming when the dead will hear the voice of the Son of God." All the dead are going to live again. Three verses later, in verse 28, John 5, verse 28, "All that are in the graves will hear my voice and shall come forth." So it's important for us to remember these things. And we need to understand that in Revelation chapter 3, verse 10, talking about this Philadelphia era of the church, the sixth of the seven eras of God's church, in Revelation 3, verse 10, we read about this Philadelphia era, and we discover that this era continues on until and on through the time of the great tribulation period. People, of course, will come up with every idea under the sun where prophecy is concerned. Once you begin to talk about prophecy, somebody says, "I think this," and somebody else says, "I think that." And as many people as you talk to, you get that many ideas. But they're human ideas. They're human ideas. What we need to do is to read what the Bible actually says. That's what we need to do. Not have all the ideas that float around. Everybody I talk to, I hear a little different angle. And I get phone calls sometimes from some of the other splinter churches, talking to somebody yesterday for quite a long time. From one of the other churches, looking for speakers. They don't have enough speakers. I said, "Well, I've got enough headaches with our church. We've got so many groups going now that you never know whether you're coming or going." But everybody's got their own idea. And what's happening, where we are in prophecy, are the seven ages of the church actually ages or not? Many of the splinter groups have stopped talking about the seven ages of the church. One reason for that is that we were so clear and adamant that we were the Philadelphia age, that if they're something else, what does that mean? They could only be the Laodiceans. And some people don't like to talk about that. Now, people do not realize that in the evangelical world at large, a big percentage, probably a half or more, of the evangelical world sees a time frame in the seven churches of Revelation 2 and 3. They see a history of the church there, but they're looking at the visible church. They're looking at the movements through church history. The great build-up of the Catholic Church after Constantine. The Reformation in the Middle Ages. So they look at the events of what's considered church history and try to identify that with the seven churches of Revelation. And of course, that means that because they mainly feel we're close to the end of the age, we must all be in the final age of the church. So universally, with evangelical churches, I say universally, there may be one or two exceptions, but universally amongst the fundamentalist, Bible-believing evangelical churches, they assume that they are the Laodicean church. Some talk about it more than others. A church like the Seventh-day Adventists actually believe that their church specifically is the Laodicean church prophesied in Revelation chapter 3. They believe that God raised up the Seventh-day Adventist church as the final Laodicean era of the church. They believe that there are true Christians scattered in many, many other churches, but they feel the Adventist church is the Laodicean church. I don't know. Time will tell. Who knows what the future holds? Well, Jesus here in John 5:28 said that everyone is going to be resurrected. Everyone would hear. And here in Revelation chapter 3, verse 10, we read about this Philadelphia age of the church. And we see that the Bible teaches this age of the church didn't stop in 1972. It didn't stop after the third 19-year time cycle in 1991. It didn't stop when Mr. Armstrong died. This says something else in Revelation 3, verse 10. Let's read that verse, Revelation 3, verse 10. Fear none, that's chapter 2, sorry. Revelation 3, verse 10, because you have kept the word of my patience. Or in the Revised Standard Version, the RSV, because you have kept my word to endure patiently. Or because you have kept my word of patient endurance. So this age is going to be a confusing time. This age of the church in which we find ourselves is going to be a time of extreme difficulty for the church. This is going to be a time when there will be some who do not endure patiently. However, God is nevertheless preparing a people in this age of the church who will endure patiently for a very good reason. God is allowing a large part of the time that this church exists to be one of difficulty, one of confusion, and one where great patience is going to be needed. Because when Christ returns, he will face, and we will all face, a desperate, hopeless, and shattered world. It will be a world that is on the point of total collapse. We will find a world with a lot of destruction. Hundreds of millions will have died. Atomic warfare will have taken place. There'll be few families without loss, without death and injury. And we will be the ones who will need to encourage and inspire and teach the ways of God to the remnant of this world. We may have to be patient for years with these people because we will have to help rehabilitate them. These will be dysfunctional people by the million. I suppose in our modern terminology, they'll nearly all be special needs people, as we say these days. Notice here in Revelation 3, verse 10. Because you have kept the word of my patience, or my word of patient endurance, I also will keep you from the hour of trial which shall come upon all the world to try them that dwell upon the earth. So this is the time prophesied through the Bible as the time of Jacob's trouble, the worst time of conflict the world has ever seen. This is the time that Jesus called the Great Tribulation in Matthew 24, verse 21, and the other examples of the Olivet prophecy. Jesus said, this will be time of great tribulation, the final period of world history before God intervenes. It will be the worst time of trouble the world has ever seen. The final 3.5 years of this world's history. And of course it will end that time of trouble with God intervening to stop man destroying himself. It will end with the return of Christ. But what are we noticing here? What are we seeing here? We're seeing that this Philadelphia era of the church continues right through this time, right up to the return of Christ. That's why Revelation 3 verse 11 says, behold, I come quickly, because this Philadelphia age, the people that have this Philadelphia attitude, who are willing to patiently endure the most unusual circumstances, where many have lost the plot, where many have lost the vision of the work that God is doing. We will need to endure patiently until verse 11 when Jesus says, behold, I come quickly. Hold fast what you have. Hold on to what you understand. Realize what you've studied and learned through the decades. Some will be tempted to give up, but God tells us you need to hold on. Don't let anyone take your crown. End of verse 11. Even in the years after Mr. Armstrong died, when many were leaving this work to start their own organizations, God continued to give growth to this work. Right up to 1991, we've already had several groups breaking off, including one of the largest, Gerald Flurry, broke away, what was it, 1989, with about 3,000 to 4,000 of our members. So people were already breaking away. Nevertheless, God still gave enough growth to this work that we grew year on year, up to January 1991. That was the high point, both of our membership and our income. And that completed a third 19-year time cycle that God gave to us. Remember, the second period ended in 1972. But clearly, it was a high point for the whole work. The income was quite huge. Far more money, of course, came to Mr. DeCarch than Mr. Armstrong ever had. Those years that Mr. DeCarch was president, the income was far higher than we had had back in the early 80s. When Pasadena College closed its doors in 1990, we had completed exactly 40 graduations. They hadn't decided to close earlier. It was almost a last-minute decision that we would close the campus and amalgamate with the college at Big Sandy. And so, just out of the blue, as it were, my son was graduating that year. I was over there, 1990. And nobody had really thought about it. Oh, this is going to be the last graduation. Only later, people looked at the envoys and they thought, we've had exactly 40 graduations from the first graduation in 1951 to the final graduation in 1990. God showed us it was a time of trial and testing for Ambassador College and for the entire church. Once again, God left a clear sign that even in difficult times, he was in control. And he masterminded the events that took place. In the 1990s, of course, we had about 40,000 members that left our church. Generally, they joined many different competing groups. Others fell away, and as far as we know, didn't go anywhere. But others left. Some people may have just stayed at home. Many people assumed that God had forgotten his work. It can't be the work of God anymore, people said. Maybe God's on holiday. Maybe he's gone to the bathroom. Maybe he'd forgotten what he was doing. Maybe he needs a bit of help. Start up some other churches. But in 1997, when the last Ambassador College closed its doors, they hadn't planned to, they hadn't wanted to, but the income was dropping every year. Mr. Fizell, far from wanting to close the college, had hoped that he could become the president of Ambassador College in Big Sandy. But it was not to be. God did not permit that. What happened is the campus closed in the summer of 1997. And when we look back, we realize that God was intimately involved. We had completed exactly 50 years of Ambassador College from the fall of 1947 when the doors opened till that closing class in 1997. God had given us a jubilee. One jubilee for the work of Ambassador College, established in 1947, closed in 1997. Nobody could have planned these things, and nobody did. Only when we look back do we realize the hand of God is visible and made clear. But are we deviating a little from our subject today? We asked the question, is God in control? Is God in control of what takes place on this earth? Is he in control of his church? We humans tend to zero in on the details. We get fixated on the minutiae. You know, we look at this detail and that detail, and often we can't see the big picture. We can't see the wood, they say, for the trees. You're so close to a tree, you can't see all the rest. We get fixed on every detail. What's happening in the church? What happened last month? What happened last week? What was announced in your church last week? What did they say this week? What's going to be announced next week? You know, we get so concerned about the detail. We must always remember the big picture. God is working his purpose out, whether we understand it or not. Today, even with all the confusion and the feeling by many members that they've perhaps been abandoned by their human leaders, today, our members are in touch with more brethren than ever before in our history. Many of our members are in touch with dozens of other members. Some are in touch with hundreds. I said to my son, you must have 100 people on your Screeny said, it's 1,000, Dad. Mainly members of this work, this church. It's something which could never have happened in any previous age. So not just in this country, people are in touch with brethren in many different nations around the globe. A most unusual situation. Could never have happened at any other time in history. You know, Elijah thought he was the only one that remained faithful to God. Today, with our modern communications, we know we are not the only one. We know there are many others who have stayed faithful to God and are learning His ways and preparing for the world tomorrow. Now, some may have been swept along by other groups. I get phone calls sometimes, and I say, well, now, what church do you attend? Oh, well, I go to Cogwell, or I go to United, or I go to Living, or whatever it might be. And very often when I ask them, well, how did that happen? Why did you decide to do that? Well, I didn't do anything. The minister said, by the way, we are now such and such a church. And many of the members don't even know how the group began. I was invited to go to a little meeting in Radlett. I got a phone call and the man said, could you come along? I said, okay. I was free that particular Sabbath. I think I had something in the morning and they had an afternoon meeting. I went along and it turned out to be, I didn't quite understand, it was the Church of God International. Now you might say, well, obviously that's Ted Armstrong, or was Ted Armstrong's church. Now, from that group that originally was created by Ted Armstrong, 34 separate denominations broke away. So including the original, 35 separate denominations, all from that initial disagreement that Ted Armstrong had with his father when he broke off and started the Church of God International. Anyway, I chatted to them after the service, and the sermon was a bit difficult to listen to. The man explained to me, we don't have anyone that's had college training. We don't know anyone that really knows how to give a sermon. Could you come and give a sermon? So I said, well, I'm kind of busy. I've got a few places I go on my own, thank you. But when I talked to the members there, they had no idea. I said, well, now, when you began, you know, when Ted Armstrong and Ron Dart started, and they looked at me blankly. They knew nothing of how their church began back in the 70s. Nothing at all. They did not know their own history. And that's the case time and again. People have told me, well, our minister said, by the way, we're now such and such a church. And the members weren't even asked, didn't even know what it was all about. And especially because our distances are so great. Many people have to travel a long way to get to a service. Many of you have traveled an hour or more to get a couple of hours to get here today. So we're in an age when it's difficult even to get to any service. But we find that there are people who have stayed faithful to God. Sometimes they've been swept along by a group they managed to attend. Remember, God looks on the heart. We never really know what goes on in the heart of another person. It's easy to say, well, somebody shouldn't have done this, or they should have done that, or they shouldn't go here, or they should go there. You never really know all the struggles that go on in another person's life, another person's heart. Only God sees that. God sees the intent of the heart. He sees the attitude we have. He sees whether we're wanting to learn His way. In our work, our church, the Worldwide Church, or GCI, Grace Communion, the name, of course, is almost identical. Grace Communion International. Communion is another word for church, and international is the same word as worldwide. Grace, of course, is one of the names of God, so it's almost identical name. But in spite of much confusion and doctrinal change, this work that we find ourselves a part of still provides a framework where we can be in touch with one another. That's why we're here today. We're in touch with one another. We're in contact. We know each other. We know our names and addresses and phone numbers. This work still provides many opportunities for meetings and fellowship and Bible studies like today. This work still provides ministers who are on call 24/7. If you've got a crisis or a health emergency, you couldn't pay for something like that. It's very unusual, the blessings and privileges we have being a part of this work, part of a worldwide family. Now, what the future holds, we don't know in detail. Will our visible church, that we know today as Worldwide or GCI, both names, of course, are used in many countries, they're on the door of our office. We've got a new sign there at the office in Market Harborough. Worldwide Church of God, Grace Communion International. It's rather nice. Brand new sign. They just had it up a little while. And we are registered. We have to be registered that way in Britain. But this work provides a lot of opportunities for us. We don't know what the future holds. We don't know even if this work will continue to exist. The Bible doesn't give us every last detail. It doesn't give us a day-by-day, blow-by-blow account. The people in Judea thought they had nothing to worry about. 500 or 600 BC. We've got the temple. Nothing can go wrong. But they were wrong. God allowed them to be carried off into captivity, and the temple was obliterated by Nebuchadnezzar. So we never quite know the future. We never quite know how things will work out and what God has in mind. In the meantime, we send our support, we send our tithes to this work. And we know that God raised this work up. We know it's God's money. We know our tithes are not our own. And God does not seem to have shown us anywhere else, clearly, where we should send it. Back to our subject. Is God in control? Is he working his purpose out? Well, time is moving on, so we may not be able to get into too much detail about this. But on a day like today, the very first of God's seven annual holy days, we remember there are seven festivals, seven holy days. They aren't exactly coincident, because Passover is a festival, but it's not a holy day. We already observed the Passover the night before last, and it was the first of the seven festivals. Now we're in the days of unleavened bread, the second of the festivals. But of course, in these 7 days of unleavened bread, we've got two holy days. So that balances the circle. Because there are two holy days in this one festival, we end up with seven holy days in all and seven festivals. Leviticus 23, verse 2, we're very familiar with. We know Leviticus 23, verse 2, it says, concerning the feasts of the eternal. So these days, the day we're observing today, the first of the seven, these are God's days, the feasts of the eternal. They're not the days of Moses or the days of Abraham or the days of ancient Israel. These are the feasts of the eternal. But even before Leviticus, even before these directions were given to the Levites, people try to work out the exact way to keep the days and what date Passover should be, and they go all over the Bible, but they should go to Leviticus 23, because this was the book written for the Levites who had to calculate the calendar and had to calculate when the days would fall. People say, oh, well, over here it looks like it's on the 15th or it's some other day. Even the whole of the people of Judah, even the Jews in the world today, the majority Not all, but the majority keep the 15th of Nisan, the first month, as the day of the Passover. Today, we went by, this morning I went by several synagogues in Radlett, and I saw the security officers outside with their labels and so on. They all have security nowadays. You dare not go have a synagogue meeting without security, because somebody can come in with a gun and wipe people out. So it's a bit scary days for the Jews in this world, the time in which we live, even in our land of the free. Terrifying times. But they're keeping today as the Passover. They think this is the first day of Passover. A bit like us. We say, the days of unleavened bread are coming. Passover's coming. It's a generic term. And we know what we mean. We know that Passover is a separate occasion. But we often say Passover, the days of unleavened bread, they're nearly here. And the Jews do the same, except that when they left Judea and were carried into slavery in Babylon, they could no longer keep the Passover. You see, they had to slay a lamb at Jerusalem, the place that God put his name. And when they were taken away from Jerusalem to Babylon, they could no longer kill a lamb in the place God placed his name. They could, however, keep the days of unleavened bread and the holy days, and they did. So when they were in captivity, although they couldn't keep the day of the Passover, they kept the days of unleavened bread, but they called it the Passover. And at the end of that time, although 50,000 went back to Judea, 90% or more, maybe 95%, never went back to Judea. Most of the Jews stayed in the diaspora around the world, continuing to keep the days of unleavened bread, which they called the Passover. And today, the first day, last night, they had a meal. And it's a pretty nice occasion. They have a special plate with an egg and different things. You've read about how they observe their Seder. And they were keeping what they called the Passover. What they didn't realize is they were actually keeping the night to be observed. They were keeping the night to be remembered. All over the world they do this and don't realize it. Now, I know there are some Jews, the Karaites and others, who are very fixed on the text. And they say, it says in Leviticus 23, we should keep the 14th. And they still keep, there are those groups among the Jews that still observe Passover correctly at the beginning of the 14th day of the month. They're literalists. But remember, the most important thing for 99 out of 100 Jews is tradition. Tradition, you can hear it. And the tradition is that we keep the Passover on the 15th, so you won't shake, you won't get them to budge on that one. Well, even before Leviticus 23, when we read about God's days, the holy days, even before this, in the first two chapters of the Bible, the very beginning of the Bible, when God created man, God laid down a clue as to the time scale of his plan. He said, I'm going to give you a 7-day week. And we read those first two chapters about what God did on each day. And on the seventh day, he created the Sabbath by resting on that day. Now, we understand that 7-day week translates into 7 1,000-year periods. 6 days, 6,000 years for man's work, followed by a millennial day, the seventh day, the Sabbath day, the 1,000 years then when God would rule over man, when Christ would reign on this earth. Now, God has placed a beautifully simple chronology in the Old Testament. 7 contiguous periods of time. But he's hidden these times among a welter of historical information, dates, days, years, times. There are hundreds of historical references in the Bible, so that most people don't notice these seven contiguous periods of time that show God's entire time plan for the Old Testament period. One of those time periods is very difficult to pin down, and it's the time that begins today. Today, the first day of unleavened bread, is the time when Israel left Egypt. We'll just look at it very briefly. Exodus chapter 12. Exodus chapter 12, verse 41. This is Exodus chapter 12, verse 41. And Israel is finally leaving Egypt after many decades of slavery. A very exciting time. Exodus chapter 12, verse 41. In fact, we should begin at verse 40. Now, the sojourning of the children of Israel who dwelt in Egypt was 430 years. This is Exodus 12, now verse 41. It came to pass at the end of the 430 years, even the self same day, an exact day, it came to pass that all the hosts of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt. And actually, although they say it was a day to be remembered, verse 42, notice, it is a night to be much observed. This is today. The night was last night. That was the beginning of the 15th of Nisan, the first holy day in God's sacred calendar. It is a night to be observed under the Lord for bringing them out from the land of Egypt. This is that night of the Lord to be observed of all the children of Israel in their generations. So this is today. And people look at that and they see verse 40 and verse 41, the sojourning of the children of Israel, the existence, the living of the children of Israel who dwelt in Egypt was 430 years. And they say, oh, they spent 430 years in Egypt. But that doesn't make sense when you look at chronology. That would mean that when you'd add up the dates in the Bible, we would have about 6,200 years already passed. But I thought after 6,000 years, Christ was supposed to come. So you know there's a problem there. And that isn't resolved till Paul explains it in the book of Galatians. If you look at Galatians briefly, Galatians, and we're just filling this in, the time is just about up, but we've just finished this little bit. In Galatians chapter 3, Galatians chapter 3, verse 16, Paul refers to this period of time, and it isn't exactly what people may have thought. Here we are, Galatians chapter 3, verse 16. Now to Abraham, Galatians 3, verse 16. Now to Abraham and his seed were the promises made. A covenant was made with Abraham. He doesn't say to seeds, as of many, but as of one, and to your seed, which is Christ. Now verse 17 of Galatians 3. This I say to you, that the covenant that was confirmed before of God in Christ. So we see the beginning point of this time period. The beginning point of the time period was the covenant God made with Abraham in his 99th year. It was explaining about Abraham in the verse before. And when you go back to Genesis 17, we see that a covenant was made with Abraham in his 99th year, that he would have a son, and that everyone in the household would be circumcised. So verse 17, this I say, This is Galatians 3, verse 17. This I say, the covenant that was confirmed before of God in Christ with Abraham in his 99th year, the law, which was 430 years after, cannot disannul, that it would make the promise, the covenant, of no effect. So Paul explains the 430 years actually began with the covenant with Abraham in Abraham's 99th year. It's exactly, specifically dated. So you know when it began and we know the day it ended. If we remember back in Exodus 12, we read that very day, that's today, the first day of unleavened bread. This is the day they left Egypt. All night long they were leaving, and probably all today as well. So it was a busy time for them, that first day of unleavened bread. But that does not say that they spent four centuries as slaves in Egypt. No, 430 years since the covenant with Abraham, you see. Now, God has allowed that to be confused in people's minds. Not only have we got the 430 years mentioned, but we find 400 years mentioned. God has thrown that in to confuse the issue a little bit in the Old Testament. 400 years, people think, well, maybe that's just the same. Maybe 430 was kind of a round figure, and 400 is even rounder. Maybe it's the same time. And then in the New Testament, you read about 450-year period, and many chronologists get thrown off by these things. They don't actually let the Bible speak for itself, and they don't realize that God has outlined exact periods of time. I call them time bridges. The time from Adam right up until the covenant with Abraham in his 99th year. Nobody really argues about that time, because you can count up the years of all the people. Not only the lifespan is given, but their age when the son was born. So you can count up the exact number of years from Abraham, from Adam right up to Abraham's 99th year, an exact time period. And then Exodus 12:41 tells us that from Abraham to the day they left Egypt was 430 years. And then, of course, you've got a third period from the time of the Exodus until Solomon begins to build the temple. You all know that one in the first book of Kings, chapter 6, verse 1. That was a period of 480 years. And then the fourth period, the remainder of Solomon's reign, he reigned for 40 years. So after his fourth year when the temple was built, there are 36 years of Solomon's life. That period of time we can know exactly. The fifth period is the time of the divided kingdom. When Solomon died, the nation divided, and they were both nations, Israel and Judah, in severe trouble. That entire dynasty of Judah has to be added up. The 19 kings and the one queen in Judah, you have to add them up, and you find that the time of the divided monarchy lasted for 390 years exactly. We won't go into the details now. People try to match up the kings of Israel and Judah, and they come up with hundreds of different possibilities. It's almost impossible to match the kings of Israel and Judah. And that is not the way to do it. And we'll just look at this one verse, but 1 Chronicles chapter 5. The chronologists don't understand that you have to take the Bible literally. First book of Chronicles, chapter 5, the first two verses. First book of Chronicles, chapter 5, the first two verses. First book of Chronicles, chapter 5, verse 1. First book of Chronicles, chapter 5, verse 1. Now the sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, for he was the firstborn son. Yeah, he was the firstborn, we all know that. But because he defiled his father's bed, his birthright was given to the sons of Joseph, the sons of Israel. So the birthright was carried on by the nations that carried the name Israel, basically Britain and America today. Okay, so the birthright is now in the hands of Israel, and you think, well, we're the leading tribes. So people look at the kings of Israel and Judah and try to follow the genealogy. But they're wrong. Look, continue in verse 1. The birthright was given to the sons of Joseph, the sons of Israel, and the genealogy is not to be reckoned after the birthright. You don't count the kings of Israel to get the chronology. For verse 2, Judah prevailed above his brethren. You have to go to Judah to get the chronology. And when you think about it, it's obvious, because you look at those two nations, the divided kingdom after Solomon, Israel and Judah. Israel was cut off. They were taken captive by the Assyrians. Only Judah continued in the land until the time of the Babylonian captivity. So you have to count the kings of Judah, and almost nobody does. They all try to match up Israel and Judah, and they get in every kind of fix. There are books this thick trying to work out the chronology simply of the kings of Israel and Judah. It's an impossible task. And the Bible tells us, you've got to count, hey, they should have read 1 Chronicles chapter 5. You've just got to count the kings of Judah. And you come up with 390 years. And the Bible confirms that in Ezekiel chapter 4. It gives the answer. If you look in Ezekiel chapter 4, I think that's the place. Ezekiel chapter 4, down in verse, Ezekiel chapter 4, down in verse 3 and 4. But Ezekiel is having to act out the siege against Jerusalem. Not very pleasant. And he's told in verse 3 of Ezekiel chapter 4 to take an iron pan and set it for a wall of iron between you and the city. Set your face against it. You don't want to be connected to this city because it's evil. They've done every kind of abomination in Judea at that time. Jerusalem was in big trouble. This is just before the Babylonian captivity. And he says, set an iron wall, set your face against Jerusalem. It will be besieged, and you'll lay siege against it. And this is going to be a sign for the house of Israel. House of Israel talking in a generic term there. Verse 4, lie upon your left side and lay the iniquity of the house of Israel upon it, according to the number of days that you will lie upon it, you will bear their iniquity. So poor old Ezekiel had to lie on his side. That's a long time. 390 days, that's a long time to lie on your side. That's over a year. He must have been pretty stiff at the end of that. Verse 5, I have laid upon you the years of their iniquity. Ezekiel 4 verse 5, according to the number of days that you've got to lie on your side, 390 days, that pictures the 390 years of the divided kingdom, the period of time that Israel and Judah would continue after Solomon until the final captivity by Nebuchadnezzar. I've laid upon you the years of their iniquity, according to the number of days, that's the same as the number of years. 390 days, that's the period of time that gives us the answer to how long the divided kingdom lasted. Again, books and books on these subjects, and people cannot come to a conclusion. God gives us the exact time period. And then the sixth time period, once the divided kingdom came to an end, captivity in Judah, you know the answer to this. The captivity in Judah was, according to Jeremiah, for 70 years. 70 years, an exact time period. And the final seventh time period, this is the whole of Old Testament history. The Bible clearly delineates these seven time periods. The final time period, there are no kings after Judah went into captivity. When they came back to the land, when Ezra brought people back and 50,000 or more came back to Judea, there were no kings. They were under foreign domination. First it was the Babylonians, then the Persians, then the Greeks, then the Romans. So they didn't have their own kings after that. However, there is prophecy. You can't add up the years of the kings because there weren't any. But you can read the prophecy. You can read Daniel 9. You can read the 70 weeks prophecy, and we'll just take a moment to read that. Daniel 9, verse 25. This is the seventh last contiguous period of time. In the book of Daniel, verse 9, verses 25 and 26. Book of Daniel, chapter 9, verses 25 and 26. First of all, verse 24, 70 weeks are determined upon your people. In other words, 70 sevens would be a better translation. 70 times 7. Daniel had said, what's the future of Jerusalem? I want to know. And the angel comes and said, you've been praying about the future of Jerusalem. Daniel was in Babylon. And he'd come across Jeremiah's prophecy that there would be a captivity for 70 years. And he said, isn't it over? Haven't we had 70 years? What's the future? What's the future for my city, Jerusalem? Aren't we at the end of 70 years? And the angel says, Daniel, verse 24, 70 times 7 are determined on your people. You're worried about the end of 70 years. I'm going to tell you, 7 times 70, 490 years are what lie ahead. And he gives a lot of detail there. Now, there, verse 25. Know therefore, understand, that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and build Jerusalem, Cyrus, remember Cyrus took over in the end of the Second Chronicles and the beginning of Ezra. You read Cyrus' decree. You can all go back and rebuild your city and rebuild the temple. Know therefore, verse 25, that from the going forth of the commandment by Cyrus the Great, to restore and build Jerusalem, until Messiah, the Prince, will be 7 weeks, 7 sevens, 49 years, and 62 weeks, 62 times 7. The street will be built again, and the wall, even in troubled times. So he tells them very clearly, the amount of time from the decree of Cyrus until Messiah the Prince will be 7 sevens and 62 sevens. 69 times 7 years. 483 years. An exact prophecy from the time of Cyrus' decree until Messiah's... We haven't got time to go into this today, but it's until the Messiah's baptism. So the Bible shows 7 clear periods in God's framework that God was going to oversee the events of this earth. And when you add them all together, they come to about 4,996 years. 3,909, you can add it up yourself, but very easy. 3,996 years. Now, after Jesus' baptism, he had another 3.5 years of ministry. So you add 3.5 years to 4,996 and you're just around the 4,000th year. So God has shown us that 4,000 years of time passed by the time of Jesus' death and resurrection. That left another 2 days of the week, another 2,000 years for man on this earth. Now don't worry about a year here and a year there. When you're adding things up, you sometimes get a year off. So we may well be a year or two off here and there. Don't worry too much about it. The main point is that God shows that he has a 6,000-year plan. And we're getting close to the end of that 6,000 years. Most people doing chronology look at the world's chronology. They look at the world's assessment of history. And they think, even if they're fundamentalist Christians believing the Bible, they think that over 6,000 years has already passed. So they assume maybe Christ is not going to return. Maybe God has gone off the boil. Maybe he's not in control of his work anymore. But that is not the case. God is never losing control of his work. And he never loses control of this world. The 6 days that God has allotted to man are drawing to a close. And we have a few years, we don't know exactly how many, God has kept that a little bit hidden. We've got a few years, and this 6,000-year period will come to an end. Our job is to remain faithful. Our job is to be so doing when he comes. When Christ returns, we need to be faithful, patient, on the job, learning the ways of God that we will be able to teach to an entire world in the lifetimes, probably, of most of us here, not far away. I think time for the Bible study is up. I wasn't actually given a time just as well. But we will draw this to a close. This is the very first of God's seven annual holy days. And we particularly noted when they left Egypt, the very self-same day. The same day that the covenant was made with Abraham, that he would have an heir. The same day that God started this whole program, you might say. And that was the day they left Egypt, and it's the day we're remembering today. And just as they left the height of evil, Egypt had slaughtered thousands upon thousands of babies. It reminds us of what happened not long ago in Gaza, just out a few miles over the border from Gaza. It was an evil and corrupt system, and God destroyed the nation of Egypt, and Israel was free. We today are to learn the lesson. We need to destroy our past lives. We need to come out of this world, come out of the wrong way of life, move away from sin toward the world that God is planning. He wants to use you and me to be teachers in his world tomorrow.